Start of interview with M. Rajendra. 10th of March, 1967.
Recorded. What did you think of the whole Dynamo scheme?
Well, as a scheme, you know, it was a scheme which was interesting in the on the basis that it gave ministers an opportunity of learning what administration was and doing it not in the bitterness of party struggle, but in the basis of certainly during the Dynamo period, there was no strong party feeling because of middle class, landowner group in power. And you'll be surprised to hear, I think the caliber of the Dynamo ministers is far superior to the caliber of certainly the subsequent ministers who came in after independence.
How would you explain that?
Well, you know, with adult suffrage in 1930, the ruling group of yet the educated, English educated middle class, the landlord middle class. And certainly they were not subject to the pressures of popular democracy, not yet subject to pressure. But in the Dynamo period, the ministers did enact a remarkable body of legislation, particularly social legislation, labor laws, and things like that, which never had been even thought of in the colonial period.
Mind you, the Dynamo commissioner gave adult suffrage with that idea in mind, because even in the late 20s, when our councillors had some
majority,
they hadn't proposed social legislation of the type which they proposed in service.
Yes. That is the legislation was carried through, and also it was the beginnings of, I think, some of our wrong policies to start with,
right?
Such as making of people dependent on the government.
Mm-hmm.
I joined the service a year of the malaria clinic.
Mm-hmm.
We started it was relief of distress.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to be people in dire poverty, but dying off, too terrible, of depression, unemployment, disease. You had to go to their aid and give them assistance. It had to be gifts. Now, that concept of the obligation of the government to assist the peasantry was carried on after distress was over. You see it coming to the land streets.
Mm-hmm.
When the land development ordinance was enacted, remarkably progressive legislation, I think. I'd like to tell you something about that and how much it's theoretical to the legislation. They made provision for giving land to any peasant who was in need of land, and there was a presumption that you give a peasant land, he would be able to develop it without capital. Very soon they realized that it needs capital. In the early stages, he needs assistance to develop the land. That's it. Whereas in other countries, when the government gave assistance of a capital nature, it was on the basis of repayment. The tradition of relief during the depression was carried into the land scheme, and it was given as a gift.
Mm-hmm. Especially in the case of colonization schemes.
No, even in the case of village expansion schemes.
Uh-huh.
the villages. I worked in Matra district where, you know, even in anticipation of the land development ordinance from about 1926, they gave out certain land to peasants, a peasant society in Perlis, T.P. Perlis. And there, you got the land which was closest to developed area. Naturally, a village extension was attended to, but when land was a little more inaccessible, they found the roads had to be cut, soil conservation measures had to be carried out, plant material and forth. The government came in and gave it within free, a subsidy for everything.
And you couldn't have, for instance, used village labor for roads and things like that?
Yes, the village labor was used, but it was well, to some extent, paid for. But even the concept of a planned road system, you know, the land development ordinance visualizes taking up undeveloped land and planning its use for future. It was planned on paper, but the infrastructure that was necessary on the ground, it took a long time in coming. The capital for investment was not forthcoming. It was depression years. It was and even the small sums that were made available. I remember when I went to Matra in 1938, you know, a few thousand rupees, 4,000 or 5,000 rupees, which was provided by government for assistance to peasants, was returned on the statement that peasants of Matra were unenterprising, saying that they won't even accept this free gift. I looked into it, and I found that poor peasants would be condemned outright and never heard of any government scheme of assistance.
So it's a question of advertisement?
It was a question of bad administration. The land commissioner sends out a circular to the country and says, this is the scheme of assistance. Well, so it sent out the mudra. The mudra in the midst of all his multiple duties finds it very irksome to print it out for his. He forgets about it. And at the end of the quarter, when he's asked to explain what has happened, he says, oh, nobody's interested.
Oh, I see. Couldn't this have been gone round by circulars and singular notices and things like that?
It is at a later stage. Shall we leave? Strengthening the country by appointing young civilians, recruits to the civil service as additional government agents and additional assistant government agents.
Putting the
manager to be in charge of the land with the specific assignment to do land.
But don't you think that even they, at least both DS and Brain and the architects of this ordinance, underestimated the number of personnel which will be needed to implement
this? No, the land development ordinance is a land reformer's dream. but it's a completely impractical legislation. It ventures to solve all the problems of traditional land tenure in rural Ceylon, one piece of legislation. But it didn't take into consideration human nature, the social circumstances in which the land had to be used in Ceylon. One of the problems was fragmentation. Like they said, this piece of land shall be left to one nominated successor. It's an easy, popular legislation of that nature. But in practice, there is no alternative form of employment. The traditional landlord, which said uniform subdivision, was more in keeping with the economic reality and people's concept of their faith. I have known in colonization in later stages where colonists nominated one son and
but de facto
no, another son forcibly occupying a part of the land in the lifetime of the father and saying, I'll commit murder if anybody interferes with me. Why only that son? If there were forms of physical employment for others outside, all right, by all means, you don't need legislation. In fact, many countries where the problem of fragmentation doesn't exist. It's all not by legislation, but by the facts of life.
Now, I noticed that Farmer has made a similar point and said, argued that this law, that they nominate, this regulation, that they nominate one year, has led to increased family disputes. But this implies that there were no family disputes under the previous system, whereas there were...
There were heaps of disputes. But I would say the emphasis would be this way, that the legislation did not solve the problem it appeared to solve. That is, fragmentation and the existence of disputes relating to that.
You mean they have continued?
They have continued. Mm-hmm. And possibly had this beneficial effect in that they did not waste their resources going to court, because the law was one thing, reality was different. Maybe it led to more murders than to litigation.
Which is better?
In our present population problem, worse.
You mentioned that the shortcomings in the income structure.
Yes.
Was that realized in the, say, the late 30s?
In the late 30s, you see, I worked out in the field. We were bringing to the notice of government the fact that these difficulties existed. Well, I remember first when they said, for village expansion, no money was provided to clearing the land. Next, money was provided to carry out soil conservation. The land that remained uncultivated in Mark district was still slow in the village area. So we clear the jungle, the peasant got chain of crop off it. Then if he did not carry out necessary soil conservation measures, he destroyed natural wealth. The topsoil was washed out. So we provided soil conservation measures. Then, and after the chain of crop, he put in a permanent crop, long time for any return to come in. He went back to his village and stayed in his farm and house, He wanted for the permanent crop to be looked after, he wanted that to live on the land. So they started by giving him 15 rupees assistance to build a house. He gave it a very fundamental 1,000 rupees for village expansion assistance. But they started in a small scale, 15 rupees, you build a house.
Again, today you don't give 800 individually. How much do they get individually?
For an individual house, they get 800 rupees.
Oh, 800 rupees.
800 rupees. In the colonization scheme, the house costs about 4,000, 5,000 rupees.
That's built by government.
Built by government. Yes, there in the village expansion scheme, the man gets assistance. He gets about 800 to 1,000 rupees. I don't know whether it has been increased since I was in the end, but I think that's a long time. 14-15 years ago.
So was it realized that this headman system was unsuitable for?
Yes, it was realized that the traditional headman, preoccupied with his traditional duties, neither have the time nor the inclination to attend to this work. Then they establish the system of village land development overseer.
Yes. Who were trained at village, at the rural farm schools to come in and undertake this type of work. They also established supervisors of LGO allotment. Well, gradually, a field organization was built up to undertake land work. Well, possibly necessary at that time because the traditional district administration was unable to cope with it. Now it's a problem that every single department of government has got a field organization of its own, and you find a series of officers tramping on each other's toes at the village level. We've just prepared a report suggesting we have reunification of reorganization of village level officers and have one man to undertake all government welfare services in a smaller area.
That's interesting about these village level officers. How useful were they? Because there's always the danger that these groups of officers become little hidden gods who oppress the people.
The village has been, the LGO overseer covered a fairly large area. He did only one type of work. He was transferred. So he did not take root in the area and establish himself. When people present had to depend on them for getting their money, they did have opportunity for corruption. The rules at that time were very rigid. That LDO officer picked out and then he reported the amount of work that had been done. An officer from the Kachiri, the additional HEA, had to go measure out and pay. Well, it was very helpful and certainly unrealistic to expect a chap to do that. The whole of Mahatma district. I did it for some years, but the amount of work that was being done was very little. The peasantry really took advantage of government schools.
It would be impossible
for the machinery that was created would have been unequal to the task. So there had to be much greater dedication of powers. I think now it has happened.
And you think the machinery is adequate in the point of numbers?
No, machinery is not adequate. I think that the whole class of things is conceived. I think to some extent of the Russian concept of centralized planning and development by exhortation crept into the thinking of government politicians and administration in the 30s and continued, and 30 years continued. Take the land development ordinance, you say if when you take the land, you map it out.
Yes.
And then you plan future use. You say you give the plan on a permit, and when the man has fully utilized, improved the land, you give him a grant, subject to a restricted tenure. You cannot sell, you cannot mortgage, you can leave it to one nominated successor. The demand for land in the 25 or 30 years, it's so great. That the whole machinery visualized by the person who enacted the land development ordinance does not work. The legislative framework doesn't work. I think more than 80% of the land yet remain unfurled.
Yes.
It has not been converted into a grant.
And one shortcoming is the survey department. They can't cope with it.
Yes, they can't cope with it. They can't cope with the issue of plans for. At the time that the land development ordinance came into existence, also government's activities in land extended tremendously. There's more resources.
portal being available in the portal up there at particular, it expanded tremendously. They were always trying to cope with new service, particularly in the colonization area. Then it finalized it.
There was
the old.
And the confusion
on these holdings must
be fantastic. And take another. You know, I think the land development ordinance to some extent retarded economic growth in the country. What is the valuable security that a person in the village possesses?
The land he has cultivated and improved.
But you have elected, he has cultivated and improved and created a valuable security. But the law prevents him utilizing it as a valuable security. He cannot mortgage it, he cannot sell it, he cannot do anything with it.
Yes, but the point is, you're caught between two stools here, aren't you? In the sense that he complains on this score that he can't mortgage. But he would be the first to come and complain to you after he has mortgaged and lost the land.
Yeah, can you prevent him? Can you, by law, prevent human beings from all the follies they perpetrate? In the effort to save, it is true that the land grabbers, some of the richest men in the southern province, are people who grabbed the village land. They bought an undivided share of the village holding. They next went to the district court and instituted a partition. Then they went round to the other corners and said, if you go to court, the lawyers make the money. You settle with me, you get a little. They did grab the land.
Weren't some of them also lawyers and doctors and notaries?
Oh, there were village people, the village bookkeeper, the surveyor of the village, the lawyer. Very largely in Mathura district, it was a neighboring village landowner, for instance. One of the richest landowners in the area was Mr. Ranaweaver. His son is a member of parliament for New Delhi. His father is the first land grabber in his locality. The interesting feature about Mathura district was the Mudaliar Vanathiram of the British period, their descendants were not the rich people. The Vidhana Arachi, who was
the village.
Vidhana Arachi was not the village headman, the intermediary between the Mudaliar and the... It is their children who are the rich landowners. And I think they are the people who grab the good crown land and also engaged in land grabbing. The Ranaveer is a descendant of the Vidhana. It is Sarath Vijayasingh. They say Vikramasingh.
Descendants
of Vidhana Arachi.
Does this mean that they are also higher caste?
Well, generally, the Vidhana Arachi team were of the Vaidhava caste.
Now, this feature in Mathura, is it different, say, from Kegala or West Colombo? In the sense that in those districts, the top officials...
You know, the top officials spent so much time maintaining status that they exhausted their resources, possibly entertaining the government agent or aping the government. The Vidhana Arachi, who had no such pretensions, and certainly looked around and grabbed the money and finally established himself in a sound financial position.
Mm-hmm. Returning to the land development ordinance, what you said would imply that the several aims which they had in enacting this were really at cross purposes, in the sense that in attempting to prevent them alienating the land,
Yes. They
were restricting the availability of capital.
Capital for expansion, for take the colonization, the opportunity, village expansion. The opportunity was never so great. Take the colonization schemes. I worked in Anuradhapura, Purnalur, under my charge. There you found the original colonies, the little 5 acres of sand, 3 acres of highland, had to get the guaranteed price in proving some of the chaps were good cultivators, pioneers, really real enterprise. Having done a good job of work, there was no further scope for them in Bolivar. What did they do? They subject their land and came back to their village to invest their capital. They did not become the natural leaders of the community in the area where they made good. They gave it up and came back. And sometimes the law itself was administered in an unimaginable manner. How many persons have been notified that each block of land was a going so much there, it's such a poverty. Then we wrote back and said, he's using his land for a commercial purpose, and somebody in the factory, he should have known that. He did too.
Mm-hmm. I see, yes. In fact, would it be correct to say that in the minds of the architects, they were against Andes and other forms of sharecropping?
Yes, they were against Andes, any form of sharecropping. Mm-hmm. They were, they had theoretical picture of a self-sufficient peasant. Unambitious! They conceived that a peasant having, I don't know what standard of living they visualized, but maybe in the 1928-29 when the Land and Commission sat, not a self-sufficient peasant, but a subsistence with rural family. The size of the colonization holding, the size of the village extension and documents has changed. Unguided by any thought as to what livelihood was visualized for the owner, what standard of living was visualized for the owner.
How did they fix on this 5 acres, the 5-3 combination?
Well, I think Mrs. Giesel and I have picked on it on the basis.
Harry has to continue, I think. And the land development almost.
Yes, we were talking about survey being inadequate and some of the objectives not being achieved. And I was expressing the view that you cannot, I don't know whether it is, I certainly, when I was younger, felt confident that I could organize society according to my wishes. I feel that there are much more impossible, and this effort to centrally flat is not very successful, and particularly with land, I think you must allow free play of the normal incentives of human society. So in the land development ordinance, you removed from the peasant the use of his most valuable security to raise credit to increase his activity, his sphere of economic activity. Which I think is to a very large extent explains why the peasant is dependent on government grants. If he has no, we have expanded the piece of bank into the countryside, but if the peasant has no security that he could offer, his credit, he is not credit worthy. If by law you prevent him mortgaging his property,
but couldn't they associate it with a combination of a government credit and allow him to give this as security to the people's bank and the people's bank only?
Yes, that is some of the modifications that the Land Commission in 1956 suggested. But you know, one of the fantastic things that has happened in Ceylon is that as a result of the generosity of the government, people don't feel obliged to return any credit extended to them by government. They think the government gives you credit, why don't you return it? Take unwritten, CFPS, cooperative credit that has been extended, large sums outstanding. The democratic process at every election, every candidate, goes on and promises that he will ensure that all credit due to government cancelled. I was in Andhra for a week, and there was a fair amount of seat value loans outstanding. Well, the Liberal Parliament campaigned up against it, I get it all wiped out. When I was 63, did he
live up to the promise?
Oh yes, certainly. Did prevent my putting the bonds in suit. When I put the bonds in suit, he came to the ministry and said, we've had bad crop after bad crop for the time. Okay, by the time I did, I was asked to postpone it.
Regarding, but still, your suggestion would imply giving it to them on freehold tenure. What is there to prevent the land rubber gaining there?
There is a possibility of the land grabber gaining the land, but I would say, even if the old society where the land grabber operated, there was no organized benefit in the countryside, or even for the Ceylonese landowner. The Ceylonese commercial bank. In Ceylon operated to provide credit for the import-export trade. Ceylonese landowners have to resort to the chettiar with 18% credit. Now that banking facilities have improved the credit facilities, and somehow we have created a society of persons who are dependent on that. We have not really, although the ambition of the person who enacted the land development ordinance was to create a free and independent presence, a sufficient presence, we almost created a parasitic society, where people who want to live off the government.
And politically, doesn't this mean that no government will be able to satisfy them, and therefore they will be against every government at the election?
It comes to this, that we have adopted political institutions, adult suffrage, at a time when we haven't reached the degree of affluence to provide the social services that go part and parcel with adult suffrage. Take the history of European countries. Adult suffrage is achieved when the countries have reached high degree of affluence, when the social services that are demanded by persons who have political power, the vote, can be afforded. We've got the suffrage, we have the affluence, and we are
struggling.
I don't see what the end of the road is. I've been wondering whether the Puritanic tradition of Western society, which built up that created a virtue of thrift and accumulation of capital. In our society, we have no such tradition. So, we have capital for capitalism living, we have democracy, we have none of the traditions that have gone to make a prosperous democratic society with that market force property. All our institutions are borrowed. We have not evolved into them. And I have a feeling that we must inevitably go through periods of a long period of lack of stability before we adjust our society to, and whether as a result of rising education, large numbers of population, creating high expectancy. Well, we will not have the revolution before the adjustment is reached. I don't know.
Coming back to the land, to the LDO, and its aim of preventing sharecropping, which is made an offense punishable by eviction, wasn't it?
Yes, you could cancel the permit and evict get the land back.
What do you think of the aim? Was it reasonable, justifiable?
Sometimes, first, you have the man who took a piece of land and did nothing about it.
Yes.
So he had to be evicted. You have the other man who, because the headman gave wrong information, you had wide acre roads there, also grabbed this and put a tenant out of it. When you are giving land out in such generous terms, you must have some means to ensure that land went to the actual person who was most in need. But came a stage, if a chap really developed the land, improved it, I think, as a result of his enterprise, he reached a middle class status. Must he remain a cultivator? Isn't the law unnatural that it compels him to, when he has acquired the wherewithal, to engage cultivators too?
But isn't sharecropping an inefficient form of...
It is an inefficient form, undoubtedly. It is a... sharecropping, again, isn't it rather a symptom of general social conditions? If there's a shortage of labor, you have a social conditions where there is unemployment. So, I think in the Land Development Ordinance we've endeavored to tackle many of the symptoms of social ailment and not the fundamental causes. Fundamental causes was that we had an inadequate investment and economic growth.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think that with regard to this LDO and its aims, there's also a sort of a strange mixture of trying to resuscitate the past, you see, the ancient glories and a sturdy yeomanry, and at the same time to increase production. And
there's a lot of confused thinking, and in the process of administration too, there was the production was thought of in terms of subsistence. I wonder whether you heard of what happened in Kalupara district. Land, which was ideally suited for rubber, was given out to peasants. And they were restricted to a condition that required them to produce only one-fourth of the land could be used for cash crops, two-thirds for food crops. The land of peasantry, which was used to having village holdings of rubber, parked the whole land in rubber. Do you know that the government, on the government agency instruction, a large acreage of rubber was removed, destroyed? It's true, there was the rubber restriction at that time, but it was a very narrow interpretation of the intention of the ordinance when the peasant was asked to remove acres of rubber which he had planted on his own.
Don't you think that this was partly due to this attachment administrative, that is the architect's attachment to the uneconomic, well, one of the most uneconomic forms of production in Ceylon, that is rice cultivation, whereas there are some other crops might have been...
I don't think it was not the cultivated attachment, as far as the, you know, even, maybe Mr. G. Selenaika himself was attached to the production of food. And the economic use of land to maximize returns on investment, you know, was not a concept that played an important part in Mr. G. Selenaika's thinking. In the early 40s, I was emergency agent at Urugala in Kandy district.
Mm-hmm.
And Minipay colonization scheme was within my area. It was Mr. D.S. Selenaika's favorite scheme. He used to come there once a month. He used to come and stay in Belvedere, Kandy. Early morning, he used to pick me up on the roadside, and we used to travel, take about 3.5 hours from Urugala to Veraganthapet into the colonization scheme. And I used to have many interesting discussions with him. I remember once asking him, are you satisfied that the investment on colonization schemes is the best use of available capital? He was indignant that I should even have asked him the question. The question of investment and return did not concern him. He was reviving the ancient tradition of the ruler. Any great Sinhalese king was a person who established and revived the cultivation of paddy, the basic food of the country. You know, modern concepts of investment and a return on investment did not, I think, play a very important part in Mr. G. Selenaika's thinking. And I think he influenced land policies right up to his death.
So, in a sense, there's too much of emphasis on the social side, preventing land grabbing, creating a sturdy peasantry, at the expense of economic return.
Yes. There was, you know, the cultivator also, it was the traditional vocation of the village peasantry, the prestige employment is to go paddy. The politician too, the minister in charge, accepted that as the best use of land. It has only been much more recent times that it's looking at land development or use of capital or cash resource in a manner that it will produce returns which would support self-sustained growth. That is very recent thinking.
Turning to the question of eviction in your time, late 30s and early 40s, I gather that if these grantees were caught out sharecropping the land or having sort of left the land, they were evicted.
They were evicted. In fact, in Mahapara district in the 1930s, I evicted very large numbers of them. Mr. D.S. Selenaika as Minister of Land, there was a right of appeal to the Land Commissioner, and ultimately a right of the Minister to issue directions, did not intervene. But latterly, that power of eviction was a dead letter.
In the 50s?
In the 50s.
Even under the UNP?
Oh yes, even under the UNP, it became practically a dead letter, because the Member of Parliament intervened and there
this is political pressure, really.
Political pressure.
Mm-hmm. So then isn't that defeating some of the very purposes of the ordinance?
Oh, yes. You've set up a framework of law which you're unable to maintain even in the political circumstances in which you operate.
No, but that couldn't have been anticipated in 35.
You couldn't have anticipated in 35. But, you know, I remember attending an FAO conference in the early 50s, and the FAO, many of them were academics, were preaching land reforms for the underdeveloped countries. And everything that was in the land development ordinance was recommended as ideal. And I told them, yes, we have the land reform as a dream, and we know how inadequate it is to work.
In fact, regarding that, you see, our land reform step in 35 is a limited step in the sense that it only applied to future grants. And therefore it was coexisting with the traditional system.
With the traditional system.
And how did that affect the work, you know?